Welcome to Culturetopia, NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. There's nothing shy about this week's edition of Culturetopia. 31-year-old director Ty West has three movies coming out this year. His latest, The Innkeepers, is part of his ongoing project to ratchet up the suspense and bring down the body count in horror. RuPaul talks about his life, career, and dragging drag culture into the mainstream. And a lost speech by Malcolm X is found. But first.
Time now for another home video recommendation from our movie critic, Bob Mondello. With the silent film The Artist in competition for this year's Best Picture Oscar, Bob's been thinking a lot lately about the pre-talkie era. Then, just a few days ago, a new old movie crossed his desk. The last silent film to win for Best Picture has just been released on Blu-ray. It's the 1927 flying ace epic, Wings.
World War I biplanes dive through clouds high above a battlefield. Dogfights in the air, bombs on the ground, and all of it without special effects. Wings is an old-school epic, enormous in scope and basically real. The U.S. Army provided 220 planes, several thousand soldiers, and all sorts of logistical help. There's a story, and it's a rouser. Two doughboys go off to war, both in love with the same girl. Rivals at first, they become friends, but then, well, more you're not going to get from me. Suffice it to say that there's a reason Wings won the first ever Best Picture Oscar. That was the year the jazz singer brought sound to film, so Wings had to be bigger, better, and louder, too. In big cities, it was accompanied by a full orchestra with sound effects guys in the theater to provide the roar of planes and bullets. To recreate that for the Blu-ray restoration, the filmmakers went back to the original shooting script and musical score, so they knew exactly where the sound effects should be, where the orchestra should burst into Mendelssohn for flight scenes, and where the director wanted hand-painted yellow flames leaping from cockpits as planes went down. In an age of black-and-white silent film, those flames must have been astonishing. When director William Wellman started working on Wings, Hollywood hadn't yet figured out how to film an air war story. Most World War I planes, remember, were almost like kites made of canvas and baling wire, and were way too small to hold a cameraman and a pilot and an actor. So Wellman bolted cameras directly to the planes and gave his 20-something stars flying lessons. In the making of extras, Wellman's son remembers that leading man Charles Buddy Rogers had never been in a plane in his life.
They would go up in a two-seat plane, and there would be a safety pilot who would duck down, and then the actors flew the plane. But you have to fly those planes. If you know you've got a control stick here, you got to work it to keep it in the air. Buddy Rogers, my father said, he spent something like 98 hours in the air. When he would come down after shooting for a while, he would throw up.
Who could blame him? But the results are spectacular. Flying footage that makes the green screen trickery of modern films look downright lame. Wings has some down-to-earth pleasures, too. Gary Cooper in the bit part that kicked off his career, and Clara Bow, the It Girl, lighting up the screen silently. No wonder so many in the film industry despaired when big, clunky sound cameras came in, forcing everyone to stand in one place and talk into microphones. Spectacle and daredeviltry wouldn't make a comeback for years. But this one last time, Wings sure sent them soaring. I'm Bob Mondello.
To a movie director now, Ty West is 31 years old and he has three movies coming out this year. West makes horror movies, slowly paced with minimal gore and a distinctive look borrowed from classic 1980s fright flicks. As NPR's Neda Ulibi reports, this could be the year that Ty West finds an audience beyond hardcore genre fans.
There's a kind of horror movie you don't have to be a horror fan to enjoy. The Shining, Rosemary's Baby, and maybe Ty West's breakthrough film from 3 years ago. The House of the Devil is about a seriously unlucky babysitter who gets a mysterious call.
I must be honest, I'm in dire need of someone.
You mean tonight?
Our heroine finds herself at a shadowy mansion in the middle of nowhere with a sinister older couple. When they tell her she'll be watching an old lady, not a child, her best friend freaks out.
Do you remember the game plan? The game plan was, if they're weird, we leave. This is beyond weird. It's mental. You know, they lied to you. They lied to you.
I know.
They're liars.
Okay, I know you're right. But it's $400.
The House of the Devil is set in the 1980s, when the news was filled with real-life prosecutions of allegedly devil-worshipping preschool teachers. Ty West is just old enough to remember Satanic Panic.
I'm an only child, and I'm a bit of a weirdo, so I really kind of absorbed everything around me. So I do absolutely remember my mom telling me, you can't go down to the park by yourself because a van will come along and kidnap you and sacrifice to the devil. And she believed it.
The House of the Devil established Ty West as a masterful mimic of 1980s horror, from the rotary phones to the credits font. But West dislikes being pegged as the vintage horror guy.
It's one of those things that just everyone said is this sort of great homage to the 80s, and really I was just making an 80s period piece.
That might be a little disingenuous, says Adam Hart. He's an academic who studies horror.
There's a loving fetishization of the clothing and hairstyles. I don't think I've seen a Walkman play such a prominent role in any film ever.
The deception with
the babysitter, having taken the job, is alone in the house. She dances on the furniture, pokes through jumbled drawers, peeks into dark closets, and explores room after ominous room.
You know, every time she walks in a room, you think, well, the movie's called House of the Devil, something's going to pop out at her and kill her, and it doesn't happen. And then she goes into another room, and it doesn't happen. And she goes into another room, and you're like, well, it's got to happen in this room, and then it doesn't. And then she goes into another, and you're like, well, it has to happen in this room because it'd be insane to have her go into this room and not have something happen. And then when it doesn't, you kind of have to give up on being ahead of the movie.
That oppressive suspense reflects the tedium of low-wage work and how we pass the time, says film scholar Adam Hart.
It introduces the horrific and the supernatural into sort of everyday rhythms.
The director grew up in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. His mother works at a hospital gift shop. He sold jeans at Diesel while shooting his first feature film.
I've had every minimum wage job known to man. I don't want to go back to the minimum wage jobs, but I have a fondness for that. So I wanted to make a movie that encapsulated that feeling of being sort of stuck at work and the kind of apathy that comes with it.
What's up, Claire?
Hey.
In his new movie that just came out, The Innkeepers, Ty West toys with another favorite horror trope, the haunted hotel.
Do you know the story of Madeline O'Malley? She was the woman that died here in the hotel. She hung herself after her fiancé stood her up on their wedding day.
The innkeepers are not the inn's owners. They're a couple of workers. They clean, answer phones, and pull pranks on each other to stave off the boredom of taking care of the inn and its demanding guests.
Why do you think she sticks around here?
Beats me. The rates aren't that cheap. The courtyard by Marriott out on Route 13 is much better.
No, not her. I mean, Madeline. What do you think she wants?
I don't know. I don't spend my time trying to figure out what women want, especially dead ones.
Please.
The only thing that inspires Claire is searching through the hotel after hours for evidence of a ghost.
This is EVP recording of the laundry room.
It's a haunted hotel. You know how that works out in a horror movie. Larry Fessenden is a respected independent horror director who produced the film. He says Ty West's deliberate, slow pacing subverts not only the frenzied rhythms of contemporary horror films, but the rhythms of contemporary life.
There's obviously the slow food movement and the slow this and that movement, which is just to say everybody take a chill pill and get off your iPhones and just sort of take in life again. And I feel that in some odd way Ty's doing that in his filmmaking.
Fessenden appreciates what he calls West's observational approach to horror and the craftsmanship he brings to a genre that can feel cheap or over the top. By probing and prolonging the chills, he says, he's making them more meaningful. Netta Ulaby, NPR News.
Our next story came to us from Malcolm Burnley. He's a senior at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. And last semester, he took a narrative writing course. And one of the assignments was to write a fictional story based on something true, but that true event had to be found inside the university archives.
So I went to the archives and started flipping through dusty compilations of student newspapers. And there was this old black and white photo of when Malcolm X came to speak. But there was one short article that corresponded to it and very little else.
May 11th, 1961. Malcolm X came to speak at Brown University. And Malcolm Burnley noticed that at the end of that story, there was a brief mention of another article also from the Brown Student Newspaper, this one written by a senior named Catherine Pierce, and her essay was the reason Malcolm X wanted to visit Brown.
So I immediately started asking her what she remembered about provoking Malcolm X to come, as the paper said, and she slowly started remembering the story of what happened.
I just felt that integration was a better path, more reasonable and with a greater chance of success.
That is Catherine Pierce. Today, she lives about an hour north of New York City. When she was a student in 1961, she believed the Nation of Islam's message of separation of the races was destructive. So she wrote a detailed critique, and somehow it caught the attention of the Nation of Islam.
Then about 2 weeks after, representatives of the Nation of Islam called the Brown Daily Herald. They said that Malcolm X wanted to come to Brown to defend his views because Catherine's essay was so critical of the organization.
Well, I think we were quite astonished.
The editor of the student newspaper was a 19-year-old named Richard Holbrooke. Yes, that Richard Holbrooke, the late legendary diplomat.
Holbrooke and his staff agreed with the Nation of Islam that they would like to have Malcolm here. But then the trick was convincing the university administration.
The university was worried about possible violence, worried about upsetting the NAACP, which had pressured other universities, including UC Berkeley and Howard, the historically black university, to prevent Malcolm X from speaking on their campuses that year. Holbrooke met with Brown president Barnaby Keeney at least six times to try and convince him.
Richard, as usual, said, "What have we got to be afraid of? It's better that we let him speak, and it's better that the students make up their own minds than that we shut him out."
Cady Martin is Richard Holbrooke's widow. According to Malcolm Burnley, Holbrooke took a hard line with the administration. If they didn't agree to allow Malcolm X to speak at Brown, Holbrooke would move the student newspaper off campus and break its ties to the university.
But in typical Holbrooke fashion, he prevailed. He used to recall walking with Malcolm X and his gigantic bodyguards from Richard's office in the Brown Daily Herald to the auditorium where the students waited. And that walk left a deep impression on Richard, who even as a 19-year-old, was already a budding historian.
Catherine Pierce, who wrote the essay that prompted the visit, recently unearthed a recording of that night, a recording she kept in a box in her attic for 50 years. This is the first time it has ever been broadcast, an extraordinary historical record, an early window into Malcolm X's evolving views and the young future diplomat who would bring him to campus. Here, then, is 19-year-old Richard Holbrooke.
On behalf of the Brown Daily Herald, I welcome all of you to Sales Hall. Tonight, we present two different viewpoints on the American Negro and his future.
Malcolm X and his entourage purchased 200 tickets for Nation of Islam members from Boston to train down. So you can hear in the audience there is between 100 and 200 Nation of Islam members in attendance.
Catherine Pierce was allowed to make a brief statement right after Richard Holbrooke.
For those of us who feel that the Negro is an integral part of our culture and who advocate integration because we believe in the equality of all men, the black Muslims are an indication of the fact that we have not done enough acting to make our position acceptable to the Negro dissatisfied with his present situation.
And a few minutes later, she introduced the main speaker.
I now turn the platform over to Minister Malcolm X Shabazz.
Mr. Moderator and Ms. Pierce, and to the Brown Daily Herald, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, that takes in everybody.
Malcolm X was supposed to debate a representative from the NAACP that night. He was representing the Nation of Islam, of course, and its leader, Elijah Muhammad. But in the last minute, the NAACP representative, Herbert Wright, backed out.
So, kind of on the fly, Malcolm had to prepare a speech for that evening. And he reveals a lot of his ideology and positions that are dated to years later in his life.
So the question today is the Honorable Elijah Muhammad a bona fide religious leader, and are his followers a bona fide religious group? And this is a question that America has got to come face to face with.
At several points, you hear raucous applause, clearly from the Nation of Islam members, based on the point that Malcolm X makes. And other points you hear, he kind of plays to the white audience and he gets them laughing.
They don't have a history of their own, so they let you tell them what their history is, and that, in essence, is that you found them in the jungle someplace with a spear chasing white people in a cannibalistic way to try and give the impression that white meat is the only good meat to eat.
And you also hear gasps at certain points in the recording at a few moments.
No follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad partakes of any alcoholic beverage, narcotic, reefers, or tobacco, which is prevalent in the Negro communities across the country, even right here in the city of Providence. He has reformed us of these things, and we used to do all of them abundantly. I myself was one of the foremost practicers or doers of everything that I've mentioned here so far, and the teachings, telling you the truth, and the teachings of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad stopped me from doing these things overnight.
At several points, he references the 725 million Muslims across the world versus the 20 million so-called Negroes in America.
There are 20 million so-called Negroes here in America, 20 million ex-slaves, 20 million second-class citizens. No matter what other classification you try and put on them, you can't deny that we are ex-slaves. You can't deny that we are second-class citizens.
And the Nation of Islam refused the term Negro. They said it was the white man's classification of black Americans. So that's why he said so-called Negro.
Malcolm Burnley interviewed dozens of people who witnessed the speech that night, and they all recalled being riveted, even if they didn't agree with what Malcolm X had to say. Here's Catherine Pierce again.
He read his audience very, very well, as a fine public speaker does.
And we who follow the Honorable Elijah Muhammad feel that when you try and pass integration laws here in America, forcing white people to pretend that they are accepting black people, what you are doing is making white people act in a hypocritical way. However, we feel that when you can change both of them and they come together voluntarily, without force or without pressure, then automatically you are furthering brotherhood and bringing about better relationship between the two races.
The entire speech lasted just under 1 hour.
It began at about 8 p.m., and after the Q&A, it extended until about 10:30. But afterwards, Malcolm X actually went to the student lounge, and he invited any of the students who wanted to talk with him more to come and speak with him. And at that point, he conducted an interview with these young white students, and he was willing to greet them more intimately and in private. And obviously, he was seeking publicity, and he wanted to be as well-known as possible. But I don't know, it definitely is a gesture to make towards young white students who, by all accounts, he wouldn't really want to have anything to do with, but he was willing to greet them and talk to them in private.
Malcolm Burnley did eventually write that narrative account of the incident for his class assignment. He's also writing a much longer version. Though Cottie Martin says her husband, Richard Holbrook, often spoke about the story, it's unclear whether he ever wrote it down. Holbrook was planning to write his memoirs at the time of his death in December 2010. The journalist George Packer is working on a biography right now. And as for Brown University?
In my research, there's no mention in the university calendar for that year or in President Kinney's notes of Malcolm X coming. It's essentially just been whitewashed from the university records.
But as Malcolm Burnley reports, that's now about to change.
Today we want to talk with somebody who has made a difference in how we work it. You may recognize that as RuPaul's 1992 dance hit Supermodel. Ever since then, RuPaul has been acclaimed as an entertainer, singer, and model. He is known for his glamorous dresses, sky-high wigs, and even higher heels. Now, at age 51, he hosts his own modeling competition for drag queens. RuPaul's Drag Race on the Logo Network opened its fourth season last week, and the episode scored the highest ratings of any premiere in Logo history. And RuPaul joins us now to talk about his work and his life and whatever else is on his mind. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
And RuPaul really is your name.
Yes, my real name.
RuPaul André Charles, if I have that right.
Yes, yes. My folks are from southern Louisiana, so I have a Creole background. And the roux is literally is the roux in a gumbo, the gravy that you make before you make a gumbo.
And your mom said, you say in your bio that your mom gave you that name because she knew that you would be a star.
Yeah, that's absolutely true.
Why did she think that?
I don't know. You know, she was very intuitive, and, you know, people from that part of the country claim to be very intuitive, and I believe them. So I grew up with that, and I knew that I would be. I didn't know it'd be doing drag, that's for sure.
How did you get into drag?
Well, I was in a punk rock band in Atlanta, Georgia, and this is the Reagan 80s, and we were into trying to sort of push the envelope. And somebody suggests we do a gig in drag, because it's really in our culture the last taboo for boys. And we did it. And the reaction I got was outrageous. So I thought, interesting. I'll take note of that.
Why do you think that is? Is it in part because you're so tall?
I think there are several reasons. And in hindsight, you know, I come from a family of all girls, and my features are somewhat softer than usual guy features. And you know what? I think it's beshared. I think it's kismet, honestly.
Did it bother you, though, that you have in your bio that you were mistaken for a girl at a young age? And I was wondering, did that used to bother you until you figured out how to work it? Make it
no,
work for you.
Well, you know what? It didn't bother me because I knew that people say all kinds of things and people really aren't that bright. Okay, there, I said it, you know? And I learned that from an early age, too. I thought, okay, I didn't fit in. I'm going to figure out how to fit in. So once I figured out what people were doing and what society was doing, I realized, I don't want to fit into that. I want to stay on the outside of that.
You do, though, say in your memoir, this is not an easy thing. A number of other performers, though, who have an unconventional path to success have also had a difficult time of it. Like, for example, Tyler Perry talks about how, you know, he lived in his car for a time. You went through some really difficult periods like that.
Sure. But I think it's difficult even if you don't choose to follow your bliss. It's difficult if you choose to do what other people want you to do. Life is not easy. And I, you know, it's a pet peeve with me with, you know, a culture where we want to make the world baby safe for kids. It's like, well, you know, kiddo, you can't make it baby safe because we've set it up to where suffering and pain is a part of life. And that's okay, because there's a way to override that.
Which is what?
Which is to go within and to understand that you are not your body. You are not your circumstances. You can transcend every situation, even, believe it or not, death. And many people have come to this planet to tell you that. You can transcend any of it because it's really all a dream. I don't want to freak people out with this stuff, but hey, that's what's going on here.
Well, but it's interesting because it's a tough message from somebody whose performance aura is associated with beauty and lightness and fun and fizz. Do you know what I mean?
I do. I do know what you mean. But really, the overall commentary on what I'm doing is saying, hey, look, I get to create whatever persona I want to. And it's all up to me. And the truth is, we're all basically the universe pretending to be humans for a brief moment in time with a little self-induced amnesia.
I'm speaking with legendary performer RuPaul. He is a model, singer, entertainer. We're checking in with him for a Wisdom Watch conversation. He's dropping some knowledge on us even as we speak. You know, talking about the fact that you're saying, look, we're all born naked and we're all in drag. We're talking now a lot more than we used to about the transgender experience. You know, people who feel they were born in the wrong body. But that's not you.
No, not at all. Not at all. People have issue with my stance on that, because the truth is, people take themselves too seriously. I think, yeah, okay, you're born in the wrong body, but the truth is, you're not your body. So why take it so seriously, you know? And you know, if it causes you pain, you know, do whatever you want to do. I'm not going to stand in your way, but I don't think it's that serious.
The drag is a performance art. I mean, you identify as a man. You don't see yourself as being other than a man or trapped in your male body or whatever, but the whole drag aura, the wigs, the heels, the fabulous dresses are a performance for you.
Yeah, it's so funny. I answer this question all the time. I don't understand why people have such a problem with it. I know, actually, I do understand why people have a problem.
I don't know that they have a problem with it.
No, it's not a problem. It's understanding the concept. It's mm-hmm. because the ego mind wants you to believe that you are all the things it says on your driver's license or your birth certificate. And so someone who decides, oh, I'm going to use all the colors in the crayon box, has to sort of be understood, when the truth is, we're all doing that. And I think drag comes up against opposition because drag queens break the fourth wall. We're basically saying, you are not who you think you are. You're actually much more than that. You know, you follow?
I do. Do you feel that there is more or less tolerance for men who like to dress as women for whatever reason, or for women who like to dress as men? You remember Lady Gaga for one of the big awards mm-hmm. shows, dressed as kind of her alter ego. What did she, I forget what she called it, Joe?
Right,
Joe,
right.
Somebody, but she dressed and she stayed in character for the whole evening. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious about your perception of how that works.
Well, we are a culture who is obsessed with masculine behavior. For a man to dress in what's considered girls' clothes or whatever, that's definitely looked down upon. But for a woman to do it, it's completely different. You know, I've had talk show hosts ask me, so why are you wearing women's clothes? And they, of course, are dressed in slacks, a blazer, and, you know, a button-down shirt. And people don't get it. And the truth is, we're all doing it. But we have a judgment against what's considered feminine or weak.
RuPaul is a legendary entertainer. His program, RuPaul's Drag Race, is in its fourth season on the Logo Channel, and he was kind enough to join us from NPR New York. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Don Cornelius, host of Soul Train. He died in Los Angeles yesterday in apparent suicide at age 75. Cornelius was famous for his impeccable clothes, his afro, and his baritone voice. NPR's Karen Grigsby Bates reports Cornelius was multicultural long before most Americans knew that word.
Don Cornelius did not like it when you called Soul Train the black version of American Bandstand. He was right to object. For one thing, Soul Train was way hipper. And for another, it was far more inclusive than many other shows aimed at teens. He made Soul Train for black kids, but everybody, as the OJs like to sing, was invited to get on board. Until Soul Train, there hadn't been a dance show aimed at a black market. When I interviewed him in 2010, Cornelius said he saw a niche.
After a short time on radio, the first thing I began to really notice is that there was no black television. That television was just white this, white that, general market this, white that.
So he created a show that would allow black teens to see themselves. Drummer Amir Questlove Thompson of The Roots explains what that meant to him growing up.
The show is very important because historically it's one of the first shows that sold us Afrocentricity.
Even the ads on Soul Train were tailored to black consumers, like this one with a Swahili chorus for the hairstyling product Afrosheen. Cornelius had exactly the right show at exactly the right time. Young Americans were finding commonality across race, grooving to some of the same music, wearing some of the same clothes. Don Cornelius became an unwitting ambassador from the world of black soul. But he was an ambassador, not a despot. The main prerequisite for appearing as a guest or a dancer on Soul Train was this. You had to have soul, period. So in addition to the Temptations and Aretha Franklin, the Jackson 5 and Curtis Mayfield, Soul Train featured white guests like the Ohio band Wild Cherry. And a group of rockin' Scots with the cheek to call themselves the Average White Band. Talk to King. Give me a little piece. Make up the cream. Talk to King. I want a little piece, baby, you know. When disco threatened to make funk and R&B irrelevant, Cornelius regrouped quickly with Donna Summer. Followed by Barry White, the Bee Gees, and others. And the beat went on. Soul Train was on air for almost four decades and continues in syndication, so Don Cornelius and his hip, elegant image will remain with us. Think about him the next time you're at a wedding and they do the Soul Train line. Karen Grigsby-Bates, NPR News.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. Culturetopia is produced by Mike Katziff and executive produced by Sarah Sarrazin. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.